NMRAP Breaking News.
So my guess is if you're listening to this podcast, you are treating COVID-19 disease patients. And if that is the case, you've probably had to make some adjustments in how your department functions. Everything from triage to discharge seems to have been affected by the SARS-CoV-2 virus. But we're the emergency department. And if there's one thing we do better than anyone else, it's to adapt. And adapt we have to all the obstacles that have appeared in caring for patients during this pandemic. So I asked some folks what hacks they've come up with in their departments to deal with these changing times. I got replies from all over. Peter Vercellio out at Stony Brook, Becky Parker, who's a former ASAP president over at Tucson Medical Center, Ruben Strayer up in Maimonides, Swami at St. Joe's in Patterson, nurses from our own shop at Virtua Our Lady of Lourdes in Camden, and even Alan Harris, a sports medicine fellow from Crozer Medical Center in Philadelphia. What's interesting is how many of them independently came up with the same hacks. So what did they recommend? Well, here's what I got. The first hacks deal with personal protective equipment. Almost everyone is wearing some variation of an N95 mask during their shifts, which means that everyone is hypoxic and hypercarbic during their shifts. Not sure why they do those fit tests to see if the mask is the right size. Just have the staff member put on an N95 mask, leave it on for 5 minutes, and then check their pulse ox. If it drops below 70 and an end tidal on them goes above 100, the mask fits. Anyway, all the masks have some form of a flexible strip to mold the mask to your nose. This form fitting can lead to stage 2 ulcers when left in place for an entire shift. Multiple sites talked about using moleskin or some other adhesive cushion placed inside the mask over the nose to take care of this problem. Band-Aids were also recommended but don't seem to work as well. One of the biggest problems with wearing a mask is the fogging it produces when you wear goggles as well. Basically, the humid air you exhale comes up under the goggles and fogs them. Theoretically, this should not occur if the mask is fitting tightly, although most of us spend the first 5 minutes of their shift fiddling around with the mask and goggles to get the combination just right to prevent the fogging. A couple of hacks were mentioned to take care of this. Lay a tissue across the inside of the mask near the top. This will prevent any of the exhaled humid air from getting up into the goggles. Use moleskin again to help make the seal. To actually tape the mask to the skin at the top of the mask. And this actually works really well, but you can only do it once. Do it a couple times and you'll remove a couple layers of skin each time you take your mask off. One of the guys from maintenance offered to caulk the tops of the masks for us. I'm sure it would probably work once. However, along those same lines, if you don't have to reuse the mask, you can put a thin layer of either antibiotic ointment or petroleum jelly along the top, and this will cut down on the fogging as well. Speaking of masks, if you have a mask that has the side elastic straps that go around your ears, they can be incredibly painful. Not only that, the straps can dig into the ears, leading to erosions and actual lacerations. I've not seen anybody lop off their ear yet, but I'm sure that case is coming. Couple of hacks here. One simple one is to use a couple of paper clips to hook the straps together across the back of your head. This keeps them from digging into the back of your ears, and it seems to work fairly well. An entrepreneurial high school student, son of one of our nurses, used a 3D printer to create a flexible strip that was about 8 centimeters long, and it looked like a double-sided comb. It had a bunch of little spikes on either side of it that you could hook the straps around, and then this went around the back of your neck and prevented the straps from digging into the actual back of your ear, and it works pretty well. I'm sure you're going to probably see it on Shark Tank soon. One of the coolest things one of our nurses did was to sew buttons onto the sides of the headbands just above the ears. The staff then looped the mask straps over the buttons, and it keeps them off the ears completely. One of the most imaginable hacks was developed by one of our pulmonologists. He took a BiPAP mask, the ones that cover the nose and mouth, and where the large port is at the bottom of it, where you would normally fit your BiPAP tubing, he placed the viral filter that we use on the bag valve mask. It seems like this filter fits perfectly in there. It looks strange, but it looks really much more comfortable than the mask we are using, and there's no problem with fogging your goggles. One problem with everyone wearing head coverings and masks is that it can be difficult to know who's who. This can be particularly troubling when you're trying to gossip about someone, only to find out that the subject of the gossip is the person you were talking to. Anyway, this is a great hack from Ruben Strayer. They took pictures of everyone without their PPE equipment on, and then what they do is each day they tape the picture to the front of their gown or their scrub suit so that people know who's who. And this is a great idea, except if you want to mess with some slightly demented senior attending and start switching the pictures around. Lord knows I have enough trouble remembering people's names when they're not wearing their PPEs. A lot of the hacks were developed to minimize actual face-to-face contact with COVID-19 disease patients. Many of these patients are in isolation rooms. In our shop, what we did is we were mostly curtains before this came along. So we had some artificial walls built. They're rather thin, but they divide the rooms up now. And so now we have people in actual rooms with doors on them. And then they have either HEPA filters in them, or if they were along an outside wall, there's a fan that diverts things out the window. So they're basically negative pressure rooms. At any rate, with people in these rooms, it's not easy to converse with them. At Stony Brook, Peter Vicellio uses iPads in the patient's room, and they have a program that allows them to call from their phones into the room and see and talk with the patients. Others just communicate with the patients by simply calling their smartphones. Becky Parker has the patient's phone numbers written on the window of the room so that consultants coming by know what the number is and can call them and talk to them as well. I'm not sure that whether this is a privacy violation, but any staff who might copy the number down could get it off the chart just as easily. And none of the EDs are permitting visitors anymore, so nobody else is going to copy the number down. So I think it's pretty valid. For those of you who are members of Doximity, that medical social network, they have an app called Dial, and I've got no relationship with them, but it was pointed out to me by Alan Harris. It downloads to your iPhone and does two things. It allows you to call the patient, but instead of your number showing up as the caller, the number of the emergency department shows up. So that's pretty cool, because this way they don't have your cell phone number and can't call you in the middle of the night. It also has a video option, so you can actually check on the patient as well when you talk to them. And this is great for doing telemedicine follow-ups with discharge patients. The video quality is excellent, and it can be used in any number of ways. If you don't want to use it for follow-up, you can use it to talk to people in triage. And even if you want to do the screening in the drive-by cars, you can do it for that as well. Speaking of callbacks, a number of us have tried to come up with ways to keep track of people after we discharge them. Ideally, it would be nice to send everyone home with a pulse oximeter to measure their progress. They could call you in, tell you what the pulse ox is and how they're feeling. Problem is, just like everything else, pulse oxes are in short supply. The people at St. Joe's, Swami & Company, came up with a great option. They use something called a Roth score, R-O-T-H, as a substitute for a pulse ox. The score basically has the patient take a deep breath and count from 1 to 30 as quickly as they can. The number can then be used to estimate a pulse ox value. A maximum counting number of less than 7 implies a pulse ox of less than 90%. The score was designed for CHF patients, but to be honest with you, if someone's having trouble counting to 10, probably a good idea to have them come back so you can take a look at them, regardless of what the underlying pathology is. One of the most interesting hacks came from our nurses, who were concerned that when we built these new rooms, they didn't have any windows and they couldn't see the patients. Their solution? Bring in their old baby monitors from home. They place the cameras in the room and the monitors at the nurse's station. The monitors allow them to watch the patients and they can see if they're struggling or if they're thrashing about and even if they're a little bit demented and getting up out of bed. Some of the monitors allow you to actually talk to the patients, and one even gave the option of playing 5 different lullabies. Actually kind of soothing when you have to go into the room and examine the patient and you hear Brahms' lullaby playing in the background. Not sure I would consider this a hack, but just a very practical idea. Most shops that are seeing a lot of COVID patients recognize that they're overextending the critical care resources, and particularly nurses. Normal ICU staffing is 2-to-1, 2 patients per nurse. However, as the number of ICU patients expanded, this ratio has not been sustainable. One hack is to repurpose other nurses and place them under the direction of a single unit nurse. You would form a team, one ICU nurse and 4 or so other nurses. The ICU nurse then directs the care of the patient through the other 4 nurses or so that are helping her out. Highly technical actions such as monitoring ICP pressures is still done by the unit nurse, but other activities and monitoring of the patients is easily accomplished with the rest of the team. Proning of patients has been shown to be helpful in those with severe respiratory distress. For many patients who are not intubated, this means laying on one side for a while, then asking them to lay on another side, and if possible, laying them on their abdomen. If they're awake and breathing, when you lay them on their abdomen, taking the stretcher and just tilting it a little bit into a reverse Trendelenburg position can make it easier for these people in getting some pressure off the diaphragm. A lot of these folks will be on either high-flow nasal cannulas or some type of BiPAP or CPAP. Laying someone face down with all this tubing can be a bit of a problem. Here's a couple hacks that were mentioned. First was take that U-shaped pillow that you see people use on airline flights, that thing that goes around your neck, and just allow the patient to put their face into that. This elevates the face, and the opening at the end of the U allows the tubing to escape and go over to whatever device it's hooked up to. Maternity, perineal, donuts, and hemorrhoid seats work well. However, just don't tell the patient what they're placing their face into. If you have access to them, the head positioning prone pillows they use in the OR for neurosurgery cases can also be used. Proning someone who is intubated in the ED can be logistically very difficult. There are a number of videos on YouTube on how to do this, but most of these are rather complicated and require a lot of hands. The tubing can also become easily disconnected when you're flipping these people around. So I usually recommend taking them off of the ventilator, putting a viral filter over the ET tube, and just having a bag valve mask ready to be placed on these folks. They'll usually tolerate the 10 to 15 seconds off the ventilator that it takes to flip them over. In the emergency room, there's probably an easier hack to get this done. Most of us are familiar with having EMS bringing in patients who are in a prone position already for one reason or another. Usually it's someone who's intoxicated and refuses to lay on their back. Our solution to these patients is simply to slide the stretcher up against the side of the EMS stretcher and just flip the patient over. They are now in the supine position on our stretcher. Same thing can be done in reverse with a COVID patient. Slide the patient as far to the edge of the stretcher as possible, even to the point of having one of the arms dangling over the side. Place a second stretcher tight beside the stretcher the patient is on. Make sure you lift the dangling arm up onto the new stretcher. Then simply flip the patient over onto the new stretcher. Shimmy them over a little bit into the middle of the stretcher and you're done. It's pretty much a simple maneuver. All you're doing is rolling the patient over, but you don't have to try and accomplish it on the narrow, just single stretcher. When you put the two stretchers together, you can just flip them over, and it's much easier to do it that way. There are a number of intubating hacks out there on how to avoid aerosolation of respiratory secretions during the procedure. These include plexiglass boxes, clear rain ponchos, or paint drop cloths. But to be honest with you, the intubation procedure itself really doesn't produce that much aerosolization. If you take your time, let the patient become deeply paralyzed, they don't cough when you put an ET tube in them. So I'm not sure these boxes and ponchos and everything else are all that valuable. And in point of fact, even if you have to bag valve mask a patient in between intubation attempts and you don't have the world's greatest seal on them, you're really not spraying that much material around the room. One hack that is worth knowing about is if you've run out of paralytics, which some of the shops are now, they're getting in short supply. There are ways to do intubations without paralytics. The best pharmacologic way, and this is what's done in the operating room when you have to do something in someone you don't want to paralyze, is a combination of propofol and remifentanil. It's usually 1 microgram per kilogram of remifentanil, wait about 10 seconds, and then 1.5 milligrams per kilogram of propofol. You got to be a little bit careful because the blood pressure can drop. And again, take your time, let the drugs really set in before you go sticking the laryngoscope in the back of their throat. One last thing, and it's more of an observation than a hack. Many of the female staff are wearing surgical bonnets while the men are wearing surgical caps. However, like all supplies, they are running low, so many of us have gone online to buy something for ourselves. And I have to warn you, if you're not careful, you can wind up getting not exactly what you wanted. I went online looking for surgical caps, and most of them were sold out, but then I found what I thought was a great buy. It was a 4-pack of caps. They were washable, they tied in the back, and they were even advertised as wicking sweat off of your forehead. So I bought the 4-pack. As it turned out, it was a 4-pack of black do-rags. But times being what they are, I wound up using them anyway. This, of course, provided the nurses and staff with no shortage of material alluding to my biker status, being a pirate, and even a hip-hop artist. Although I must admit, when I take my N95 mask off and goggles, I really look like a pretty badass ER doc. If anyone has any other hacks, let us know. And please take care of yourselves out there. Talk to you later.